I'd like now to welcome back to the program Robert Rhodes and Richard Brandt. They are part of the Live Poets Society, which is presenting a reading and also a dinner tonight called Apocalypse Soon, Our Past, Our Future. And it's all about the Mayan calendar, the end of our world. Welcome, gentlemen.
Well, it's good to be here again.
Thank you.
We'd like to talk a little bit about the Live Poets Society and what we're doing.
Yeah, so the Live Poets Society has been going on for some time because we had you on years ago.
About 4 years ago.
Okay.
The last time. And we started in 1991 and we're celebrating our 21st year. And basically, the Live Poets Society was to bring poets out of the closet because they wrote poems and never showed it to anyone, including their spouses.
Really?
And
how did you find that out?
This is, we just started talking to people, and I had written some poetry, and people said, well, I wrote it too. So I said, well, show it to us. Well, they finally did, and we began to with five or seven people, and suddenly now we're 33 people. And most of them in New Mexico, but some are out of town as well, out of the area. And we meet three, four times a year in someone's house to read poems. But what happened is that after we got to about 15 people, other people who had written books and had published poems wanted to join us because they were having fun.
Fun is good.
And so we've done that. We've published four books of our people's poems. And I have one which I'll give you afterwards.
Oh, good. It's called Live Poet Society, and it's basically selections from all these folks that you're talking about.
Yes, yes.
Put together last year.
And then what happened is we said, well, wait a minute, let's go public. And so this is our ninth performance in 21 years.
Nice.
And we decided that the theme should be the Mayan calendar, which who knows what's going to happen on 12-21-12.
I'm putting my money on nothing in particular.
Well, then you can read a poem there, too, if you wish. And yours would start off by saying nothing in particular.
I mean, somebody will have a birthday, somebody will be born, somebody will die, people will eat and sleep, there will be car accidents.
This is the booklet that we'll pass out.
Okay, the booklet is called Apocalypse Soon, Our Past, Our Future, 12-21-12, The Mayan Calendar, The End of the World. So is this, okay, so among your out-of-the-closet, so to speak, live poets who are doing this work, is this something that's really capturing people's imagination?
Oh, yes.
The idea that we're in for an actual apocalypse?
Well, the reason some people will read poems that actually have to do with that, but others will read about their past and their future, which really has to do with the apocalypse. What happened before it, what happened after it. So almost any poem that anyone has ever written has to do with time. There's something about it in time. So
that's a pretty broad definition of apocalypse.
Well, this is the best we could do with our 13 poets who are going to read. And by the way, if you want, I can tell you the names of each of these people, but we don't have to.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
I have an apocalypse poem for
you.
Oh,
good. This is yours?
This is mine. I'll read it tonight. Apocalypse Now. A year without seasons, a day without sun, a night without morning may well have begun. Heaven's a risk born out of fear. Hell is more certain and likely is here. All those who trust in God should set about to pray. Their chance for salvation doesn't happen every day. Those who believe the Mayans to say how the world will end might better trust the devil as their more likely friend.
Excellent. We're talking to the Live Poets Society, Robert Rhodes, the author of that poem. Now, there are, of course, all kinds of apocalyptic poems in the history of poetry.
Yes, yes. My favorite is, I told Richard about it, is by Robert Frost.
I know what you're going to read, and I love this poem.
This poem,
I memorized it.
Well, wait a minute. Maybe you should read the poem.
You can do that.
No, you should read it.
All right.
Okay.
Fire.
You're the live poet.
Fire and Ice by Robert Frost. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I have tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice.
Okay.
Nobody says it like Robert Frost.
Well, I'll read one.
It's funny that his name is Robert Frost and he chooses fire.
But he also chose ice.
I know.
So it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It works. Anyway, so we should have about 50 people who will come that we know are coming. More people can come. It's at the Santa Fe Community College in the Jemez Room.
Right.
And it's free if they just want to listen to the poetry. But
and there's a charge if you want to come for dinner. The dinner's at 6. The poetry reading is at 7.
That's exactly right.
Look, I can read the card.
Yes. And so we hope to have fun there and just have a... And if they bring a piano in, there's a little break, and we may sing a song about the apocalypse in between the break.
Is there a song about the apocalypse?
Well, I figured this, that the apocalypse really has to do with time. And there are a number of well-known old songs, theatrical songs, about time, as time goes by. And it really has to do with...
Humphrey Bogart.
Whether you survive. Another one, A Time for Us, from Romeo and Juliet. And they didn't last very long,
no,
Romeo
they didn't.
And Juliet. So maybe that fits into the theme.
Now, if I have to be honest here, having spoken to academic Mayanists who actually are able to read these hieroglyphics and understand what they say, there really isn't a prediction of the end of the world. It's the end of the calendar, which our friend Jerry Sabla from Santa Fe Institute, who has studied this stuff in tremendous detail, says is equivalent to your odometer going from 99,999.9 to zero.
But doesn't that change your life?
No.
Yes, it will.
The car still drives.
Well, no, that's when you run out of gas.
When we were in Mexico, I got one of these, I guess it's a simulation of the calendar. And on the back of it, it has all sorts of possibilities for the end of the world. And the one I remember was it says, at the end of four epochs, whatever an epoch happened to be, comes the destruction, and it was going to be volcano and rain, water and rain sort of thing. So it's not all just one. There are many possibilities. I agree with you. But yes.
Well, and when you think about the Robert Frost poem, you think about, for example, nuclear winter, ice.
Good.
You think about climate change and all those fires that are wildfires that are caused by, you know, human
sure.
activity and
all the tornadoes that are sweeping holes, little villages away. And
yeah.
But even if it doesn't happen on 12/21/12. Within 10 million years, the Earth will disappear.
Oh,
and
that's
we're
true.
Just saying, how do we handle it?
We won't be here.
Your mind may still be... Oh, you'll be here, because we'll have all your
on
recordings.
Tape. You'll
of
be on
your,
tape.
No. Yes.
Yeah, 10 million years from now, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.org. I'll still be paying the bills.
Maybe. We'll think about that.
Yeah,
but
if you
want, I'll read my one poem.
Please
about
do.
About the Live Poet Society.
Please do.
Oh, it's called Anthem. For whom shall I write my poetry today? As time rushes by, sliding swiftly away, is it for my own pleasure and breathless relief, or forcing on others a pregnant belief? For whom shall I write my poetry today? Placing my memories on public display for my mother, my father, and others who've died to soften the grief that oft-times I hide. For whom shall I write my poetry today to expiate sins now recalled with dismay? Speaking in verse, will it quiet the pains of transgressions and guilt my life surely contains? For whom shall I write my poetry today that documents beauty, blazing love to portray, to show mankind miracles of human delight, and to preach that chaos may not be a plight? Name for me, O my readers, male, female, or neuter, the target of my brilliant ink, pen, and computer. Well, without giving in to some gross impropriety, my poems only exist for Live Poets Society.
That neuter computer rhyme will stay with us.
I hope so.
Until 10 million years from now.
Well, it took me a long time to figure out what to rhyme with a computer.
Well, very few poets write in rhyme verse anymore.
That's true. I'd say about one third or one quarter of the poems that we read at our meetings have rhyme.
Real, and that's high.
Yeah. Well, I think still there's that many. What do you think?
Well, it depends. I think if you look at poets like Auden wrote rhymed poetry.
No, I guess I'm thinking sort of contemporary. Yeah.
But you're right. Nowadays, there's very few. If you get the New Yorker or some of that, it's more. I don't know how you would describe the difference. It's unrhymed. What is it? If it's not rhyming,
blank
it's
verse.
Blank verse. That's what I'm trying to think
of.
Yeah. I like it both ways, but it has to be good whichever way it's written. It has to work as a poem.
I write limericks.
Ah, that's good.
Which are they're worse than any other kind of doggerel, and they rhyme, and they're the neuter computer rhyme in spades in those things.
Well, please use that for one of yours. Okay?
we share.
And if you wish, you can come and read tonight.
Okay.
but you have to let us know a little in advance.
Yeah, I think I might not want to taint the proceedings with my limericks, but it's a wonderful thing that you're doing. How has it changed the way you write and how much you write to have this community of live poets?
Well, with me, I write haiku. I've got a book of haiku, which will be on sale, but that, for me, is training for the regular poems that I write. In other words, you have to control your discipline, whatever it is. And so I'd say right now I'm 50-50. Probably I rhyme and I can do blank verse and the rest.
Well, that's interesting. And also, at the meeting, at the performance tonight, we're going to have 13 people. Now, 8 of them are men and 5 of them are women this time. Mostly it's 50-50, but it just happened to be that way this time. And it's interesting, the differences sometimes between the women and men, how they write and whether they use rhyme or not rhyme.
Really? How does that break down?
It's a little hard to say, but I would say that the men have a little more of the rhyme still, but it may be that... No, I don't know why. I'm not sure.
We have some good examples in the society of both.
Yes.
And that's what's important.
And what's happened, our society, everyone who belongs to it has become very good friends, socially and other ways.
Right.
And that's really worked out very well for us.
A beautiful thing. Okay. Richard Brandt and Robert Rhodes are part of the Live Poets Society, and the event tonight is called Apocalypse Soon, Our Past, Our Future, 12-21-12, the Mayan calendar, the end of the world. And once again, there's a dinner at 6 that people can go to if they like, which there's a charge for that, and then there's a free poetry reading at 7. It's at the Santa Fe Community College in the Hemmes Rooms, and it is very easy to find. You can call if you want more information. You can call Aaron at 982-9246. Lots of poets are part of the Live Poets Society, and there's this wonderful book, which I guess people will be able to buy a copy of.
We're going to just hand that out.
Oh, okay.
That's for them to see. Many cases, people who read, they really would like, it's better if you have a book in front of you showing what's being read when you see it for the first time. or when you hear it for the first time, it's easier to understand if it's complex.
Right.
That's why we did that.
All right,
but
cool.
Anyway,
so there will be this very nicely done book that will be handed out, and I want to thank both of you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. Very good.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Carol Norton. She is with Wild Earth Guardians, back to talk about the next great participatory event of this season. Earlier we had you on talking about Stream Team. What's going on now?
The next thing that we're going to do is also part of our restoration program. We're going to pull fence in the Valle Caldera.
Really?
Yes. So it's been an interesting process watching what's going on up in the Valle Caldera. It's got a different kind of management scheme, and one of the things they do is they need to theoretically make money to support themselves, and so they graze cattle. And in fact, it's been a cattle ranch for a long time. It historically has been. Wild Earth Guardians bids on that grazing allotment each year. So first year, $35,000. Now $35,000. The second year, maybe. This year, we bid $50,000, and we bid on it to not graze cattle.
So you are getting cattle grazing land, and you're going to pull out fences and not graze cattle?
Not graze cattle. Interestingly, they don't ever accept our bid, but we have convinced them through this process and creating a relationship with them that it really doesn't make sense to graze cattle on most of the Valle. And so,
why is that?
The Valle is a beautiful place, and it is a wildlife sanctuary. There are incredible populations of elk, there are cats, there's bears, and having fences prevents them from moving freely about the landscape, which, in order to have a healthy ecosystem, you need.
Migration corridors,
hunting, you know, almost every activity that a wild animal does involves movement.
And so you have permission now to not only go in there but take down the fences?
That's correct. So everywhere where they aren't grazing and they're reducing the amount of area that they are grazing, they're now going back and asking us if we'll work with them to take the fences out, preventing grazing from happening again, unless they want to spend a lot of money putting up fences. So it's a win-win situation for all of us. We get to work with a bunch of great people who want to come up and do the right thing for our wildlife populations, and they create habitat that is more fully functional.
And so we are now making a call out to our dear listeners to participate in a fence pull.
That's right. So it's a fence pull. We'll be working three times this year on May 12th, 19th, and June 9th. We'll start at 10 a.m. You'll need to get yourself to the Valle. All 3 days are right in the main caldera, so you'll be able to see it from the road. We can give you all the details about how to get there and how long it takes, but you drive up, we meet, and then we start taking out fence, and you pull the posts, and you wrap the barbed wire up and haul it all off.
And that's it. I mean, I've gone camping up near there in Hemez and the Hemez Mountains, and I have to say, cows had free range there. They practically walked over us in our tent.
It'll be nice to have a part of our public lands that's cow-free.
Very interesting. So people can come prepared. What do they have to do? I guess have a strong back and bring a pair of leather gloves?
You're exactly right. You do want to. It is hard work. It's not easy work. It's hard work. We'll have crew up there who will be managing the whole project. But, yeah, you want to show up with boots, work gloves, pants, bring layers for the weather, bring your lunch. We'll have plenty of water, but you want to bring a water container and maybe some snacks. And come on out for the whole day. We'll work until it's done.
Carol Norton is with Wild Earth Guardians. They're on the web at wildearthguardians.org. And what is the telephone?
505-988-9126, and you can register by emailing Angelisa Espinosa at espinosa@wildearthguardians.org.
Excellent, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program artist Nancy Holt. Her exhibition is called Sightlines, and it's curated by Alina Williams, who joins us. And it's at the Santa Fe Art Institute, whose executive director, Diane Karp, also joins us. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary.
Good to be
here.
Thank you.
So this is a retrospective exhibition, I guess you would say, of work that you did in, what, mostly the 60s and 70s?
Yes, that's right.
So explain to us the term sightlines.
Well, that's more a question for Alina, because Alina came up with the title for the show.
Oh, okay.
But I guess what she was thinking of is the fact that many of my works deal with perception and vision. And it started back in the 60s and 70s that I did work that you look through and you see the environment, and you also are able to look back through the work to see other elements of the work.
It seems like there's so much about landscape and land and the outdoors, and yet the limitation of our perspective through looking at things through an aperture, let's say, or a limited view of some kind.
Seeing the landscape frame. When you're out in the vastness of the West, when you're dealing with overwhelming landscape, it's a way of bringing the landscape back to human scale, to human perception, and orienting one in space.
Bringing the landscape back to human scale is a funny idea because the landscape is so much bigger than human scale.
That's right. But that is what art can do for the landscape. It can art can allow us to see the landscape in a different way. And rather than having the landscape blur out or be so vast that we cannot perceptually deal with it, bringing a kind of a human consciousness, awareness, and vision to the landscape.
Now, you're from Massachusetts, but you ended up out here in the West.
Actually, I'm from New Jersey.
Oh, Jersey, sorry.
I was born in Massachusetts.
Okay.
But I think of myself as a Jersey gal.
And moving to the West, I mean, as many of us have done, moving out west to New Mexico or wherever from the East Coast, that's a different scale in itself. One sense of landscape is so much more circumscribed by trees and mountains and things like that.
Right.
Over there.
It's a much different feeling. That it's a vastness and a spaciousness, a connection with the sky that one doesn't feel in the East because of the trees and the concentration of buildings.
Because so the sky is so gray, you don't even want to look at it.
Yeah. That's true. More pollution in the East. Here, this is one of the least polluted areas in the United States. In fact,
it's the cleanest air in a city in all of the U.S.
Is that right? Yeah. Didn't we just get some award from the American Lung Association?
Yes, we did. But, Nancy, would you talk a little bit about the phenomenon that happened in the 60s where a group of artists really began to look to the Southwest, and why? Tell us a little bit about why the Southwest.
Well, I think for some of the reasons we were just talking about, it was also a way of getting beyond the metropolitan areas and the kind of concentration and establishment of the art world, and kind of bringing a vaster territory into consciousness and getting out of the constrictions, actually, of the galleries and the museum, which were pure spaces for precious objects.
Now, you've always worked in photography. That's been your chosen medium?
I've worked in photography right from the very beginning, but I've done many other things as well. I've done a lot of
large-scale outdoor sculpture, site-specific sculpture. And I've done film and video.
Now, when you do outdoor site-specific sculpture, and we see it in the form of photographs in an exhibition like Sightlines, is it like a document of the sculpture, or is the photograph the artwork?
I think the photograph is the artwork, even though the artwork exists and it is meant to be seen and experienced. I have also done my own photography of my sculpture, which has been a very involving aspect of it. I knew that I couldn't build sculpture far away from the art centers without somehow communicating that I had made these objects. So I spent quite a bit of time photographing the work in different lights and different angles and develop my own style of shooting my own sculpture. And that is a phenomenon in itself. And so the photography is very much linked to the original sculpture, but also exists in itself.
When you do site-specific sculptures out in the landscape, do you then leave them there and let them weather and degrade over time?
I leave them there, but I usually build them very strongly. I have always had that tendency of wanting things to last as long as they possibly could. So I build strong foundations. I use very sturdy materials like rocks and concrete, steel, and build for the ages, so to speak.
Do they tend to be seen, or are they in remote places?
Some of them are in cities, actually.
Oh, okay.
I've built a park called Dark Star Park, which is a sculpture and a park, which is in Arlington, Virginia, very close to Washington, D.C. So I've worked also in universities and campuses. And so not just in very wild, desolate...
Right, deserts.
Deserts, yeah.
We're talking to artist Nancy Holt. Now, Alina Williams, how did you become involved in Nancy's work as a curator?
Well, I first got interested in her work. I was looking at a number of videos that were distributed by Video Data Bank in Chicago. And also, a couple of her films are at the Filmmakers Co-op in New York. And I was very interested in these media in the first place, in that time period, that early moment of video. And I started looking at her work because it wasn't really that pervasive at that time. And this was, you know, about 8 years ago when I first started doing the research. And then I traveled to these places and looked at the work. And then, of course, I knew about Sun Tunnels, her most known work in Utah. But I was kind of interested in finding everything else that I could about her work that hadn't really been seen. So it just sort of evolved in that way. I was in Berlin, and I made a trip to Galisteo and got a whole slide presentation of all sorts of things I'd never seen before. Also, indoor installations that Nancy had worked on. Just all sorts of wonderful work. And so it became clear, okay, this project is much bigger than just looking at film and video, but looking at like an entire practice. But I tried to, at least in the exhibition, to narrow it down thematically, because of course in the book it's much more retrospective than the actual exhibition, which ends in 1980. So I tried to kind of keep it a bit more focused around the question of mediation and also language.
What do you mean by mediation?
Well, you have a lot of video works where she's moving between different media. She'll take a photograph of even a painting, and then videotape that photograph on on video, and then she would put it on a monitor and then videotape it again and then make that into another photograph. I mean, there's all these layers in works.
That moves from the original.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so it's a really interesting form, because I know there's one work I'm thinking of specifically in relation to this question, Underscan. It's really interesting because she talked about it on the level of almost like tunneling in on something or tunneling out a view onto an original object, but it's through these different layers of mediation. So there's a lot of complexity stuck into the work that you just wouldn't ordinarily think of if you think simply of like landscape or land art, but there's much more of like a conceptual element to some of her earlier projects.
Now let's talk about the sun tunnels. These were made in the mid-70s. What can you describe them for our listeners who don't know your work and don't know the sun tunnels?
There are four concrete tunnels. Each one is 18 feet long and 9.5 feet in diameter. And they are aligned to the rising and the setting of the sun on the solstices. They also have holes that penetrate the top of the top half of the cylinder, and they are in the configuration of stars and four different constellations, and our sun, being a star, shines its starlight into the tunnels, and there are spots of light then on the bottom of the tunnels that are constantly changing as the sun changes its position in the sky.
So they're meant to be walked through.
Yes.
And looked through.
What do you mean?
The idea of these tunnels are large-scale examples of a lot of the work that Nancy has been thinking about and working on since the 60s. And it's the idea of using an aperture. You opened by talking about that. An aperture that isolates a part of a large, complex landscape. And the ability to not be overwhelmed by the entire landscape, but be allowed, that's the human scale piece, to be intimately focused on an intercepted piece of the landscape, brings that landscape to you in a way that is phenomenal. And one of the things that Nancy said to me, which is quite brilliant, is she was a photographer before anything else, and the idea of looking through a camera's lens to isolate a piece, an intercepted piece of the larger view and select it, is where sun tunnels and much of the later work began, the large-scale work. So in many ways, stemming from the impetus and the motivation of isolated parts of a view that's photographic out into the landscape in three-dimensional large-scale work, and then bringing it back into the gallery as photography or video, is a perfect logical continuation. And the viewer gets that, especially when they come to see the exhibition.
It makes you conscious of your own sight.
Well, one thing that is striking is that if you're going to frame and limit the landscape, we're so used to doing that through a photograph, which is rectangular, and these are circles.
Yeah.
And we don't really think about it, except maybe looking out of portholes or something like that, but we don't usually think of a round frame.
No. And yet our eyes are perfect circles in the middle of our head, which is really phenomenal, isn't it? That we would have these perfect geometrical forms. And so it's an extension of the eye out in sun tunnels. Of course, the tunnels are capturing the sun as it rises and sets on the solstices, and the sun, of course, is round.
So are they lined up the way some of those Aztec and Inca astronomical monuments are, so that certain things happen on the solstice and on the equinox and stuff?
Yes. Not on the equinox, on the solstice.
What happens?
Well, the sun, there are four tunnels, and two are opposing each other, so that you're looking through two tunnels, and then the sun is setting on the horizon. So you have an alignment.
Oh, okay, so if you stand at the end of one tunnel at sunset on the solstice, you have a perfect view of the setting sun.
Right.
Cool. Is it still there?
It's still there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Very beautiful.
Do people go? Is it like a destination that people go
yes.
make their pilgrimages to?
Yes, it's a destination.
We're thinking about doing a road trip to go, the staff of the Santa Fe Art Institute. We've been talking about that, about climbing a car and driving out so that we could be there to experience the summer solstice at sun tunnels out in the middle of the Utah desert. Very beautiful.
Santa Fe Art Institute's excellent adventure.
Yes. Yes.
We're talking to Nancy Holt, artist, and Alina Williams, curator, and, of course, Diane Karp, executive director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Diane Karp, how did you find Nancy and get this whole thing rolling at the Santa Fe Art Institute? I mean, you have so many choices of whom you can show at the Institute.
Well, the Institute has always been an institution that focuses on important ideas and the kinds of ideas that really transform both art and society. And Nancy's work is a brilliant example of work whose effect was to change the way in which general population understood the actions and the role of art, and simultaneously change the ways in which they understood and respected landscape. It comes out of a moment in the late 60s when feminism was rising, environmentalism was rising, when we were beginning to look around and say that this great capitalist rush for taking over everything and turning it all into commodities might not have such a good end. And so a group of artists, Nancy being one among them, working with Virginia Dwan, began to say...
Who's Virginia Dwan?
Virginia Dwan is an inventive and innovative and visionary gallerist who had a gallery in New York City. And actually in 1968, I think it was October, if I'm not mistaken, of 68, presented the first exhibition called Earthworks. And with it, she brought the focus around not to objects, as Nancy said, precious objects in pure spaces in galleries and museums, but to the larger world around us. And so I've been a devotee and a great fan of Nancy's work for many years. I taught art history for a long time and showed her work. So finding that Nancy was also a Galisteo resident, one of the first things that I did when I came here was ask if I could come out and meet her. And so this work is emblematic of the power that the arts has to affect a broader social worldview.
So it's such a different, when you think about the kind of view of the landscape that you were talking about and alluding to, it's such a different view of the landscape than Ansel Adams or the sort of 19th century painters doing these beautiful picturesque things that we associate with our national parks. This is a whole different sensibility.
This is an engagement with the landscape directly and doing work that evolved out of the site, not in the studio, but in response to what was there already, the earth, landscape view, the materials of the place, the psychology of the place. All of that goes into the initial inspiration for the piece. That's very different from building a sculpture and placing it in a plaza somewhere, a concept that came from another interior space like a studio.
What was your relationship like with other artists who were working at that time? And were there a lot of female artists like you doing this land-based work?
Yes, there were women doing this. Matter of fact, in the 70s, I think there were as many women as men.
And you wouldn't know it from the art history books.
Well, maybe some art history books, if they're accurate.
Yeah. Lucy Lepard, I suppose.
More recent art history has begun to go back and reexamine the areas of art history that were either overlooked or bypassed. And I think that it's the nature of history that it's a dynamic. And the first book, thank God, that's written on any subject is not the last book.
Right.
But it's the book that invites people. And Lucy's work is a perfect example of opening a way of thinking and seeing to understand the art that was being made in a new way.
That's kind of actually ties right into, you know, our development of the book, which is the first book on Nancy's work, but also knowing that it hopefully is the beginning of more writing. I mean, it was never the idea that this would be the definitive book and there will be no others. I hope that there are more, and also digital books and things happening more online. You know, it was meant to open up a conversation. And so a lot of the writers that I invited into this, it's like an edited volume, a couple of them are actually practicing artists as well and working in a visual way. There's Matt Coolidge from the Center for Land Use Interpretation, who wrote an entire very beautiful essay about a public artwork that was never completed of Nancy's. And that was in New Jersey. It was called Sky Mound. And it was kind of an unopened, an uncompleted project, but one that one would hope maybe in the future could be realized. At that time...
What was it?
Yeah, at that time, it was the first landfill to be covered in all of the U.S. that they wanted to turn into the New Jersey Meadowlands Commission. They wanted to turn it into an art park. And they asked Nancy to come up with a concept for turning this into a place, an experiential artwork, a landscape that people could enjoy on site and also visually.
So and turning a dump into a desirable landscape.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I guess this sounds terrible to say, but I'm not surprised it wasn't finished. But what was your concept?
Well, actually, with the latest technology, you can make it very safe. And it would have been pretty awesome. You know, the fact that it was this big mound of garbage in New Jersey, very close to Manhattan. From the top of it, you could see all of Manhattan and northern New Jersey and the Pulaski Skyway and the New Jersey Turnpike. And it was, quite an awesome sight. And we were planning it to be... to include the whole landfill. There was going to be a solar area where you could experience the sun rising and setting on the solstices and the equinox.
But I mean, okay, so you've got a dump, you've got great views from the dump, but what was the ideal?
Well, there was a solar area with mounds, and when you stood in the middle of it, you could see the sun rising and setting through... framed by the mounds and on the solstices and the equinoxes. There was a moon viewing area where you could see the major standstills of the moon every 18.63 years. But on other years you could see the moon rising and setting and have that comparison to what the extremity would be.
How come it didn't get finished? What happened?
There was also a pond, and we did finish the pond.
Okay.
And we put plantings around it that attracted, like, there's about 250...
species
of
birds.
I think it's about 250 species of birds that are in the meadowlands. And so we planted things that would attract the birds, and then we put fish in the pond. So we'd gotten that far. Then there was a delay. You know, they just wanted to study. This is what I was told. Study the landfill for a while.
For reasons of toxicity or things like that?
No, it was not that. I think it was... It was never made clear to me exactly. There was just a delay in the project.
So I mean, if you want to delay something, say you want to study it, I suppose.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to ask you what's it like to be in a curator-artist relationship with a living artist? When I think about curators, most of them are working with, I guess that's not always true in the museum of many museums of modern art, but how does that relationship work?
Yeah, actually, it comes up more often than not. Other people are noticing that, and I was just like, well, it's great. My artist is alive. There's more information I can gather now. I don't understand how this is, like, so unusual, but I know I am more like an art historian. I am, you know, working on my doctorate. I am kind of working in a more historical viewpoint, and I know that in the past, you weren't allowed to write dissertations on any artist that was still alive. This wasn't my dissertation, but I was always working with contemporary artists, and it didn't seem that unusual to me. And it's been really like a working relationship from the beginning on. I mean, really, you know, there have been practical sides of it, administrative sides of it, but also, you know, on the creative side, you can get more like involved in the thinking, and you are coming up, you know, it's really different than just simply approaching an archive and just coming up with what you have there. You have to, you know, engage with the thoughts that are current and happening right now in the artist's mind, and then also think, giving it a historical context is also your role as the curator.
Do you see, Nancy, your work through new eyes when you've got somebody working so intensely on it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Alina's interest in certain things that I did in the past, like the concrete poems and other discoveries she made, certain photographs, and that kind of her focus on them made me refocus. And out of that came a kind of evolution of thinking again for me, going back in time, picking up something I did previously, and then having it come alive again. So I think it was a really living, vital relationship.
And the exhibition and the published book of Sightlines will allow the entire public to begin to rethink and take a new view on the body of work and the context in which it was made.
The book is called Sightlines, as is the Nancy Holt Sightlines, as is the exhibition, which opens this Saturday, May 5th, from 4 to 6 at the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, way down at the far end. If you just drive in straight, southwest corner, just keep going, you will find the Santa Fe Art Institute, these beautiful Legarreta buildings.
Yep.
And Saturday from 4 to 6 is the free opening, and the exhibition hours run through the 29th of June, and the curator-artist conversation
and the artist talk.
And artist talk are happening on Monday, May 7th at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, which is pretty much the next building over from the Santa Fe Art Institute on, again, the same campus, Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Nancy Holt, artist, Alina Williams, curator, and Diane Karp, director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary
Charlotte.
Thank you.
And there's always more information at sfai.org. The number over there is 424-5050 in the 505 area code.